You're listening to Trek FM.
Hi, this is Garrett Wong. I played Ensign Harry Kim on Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey.
To the journey!
I'm your co-host, Tristan Rendell, and with me, as always, is...
Charlene Schmidt.
Now, Charlene, you and I, we share a friendship, we share a podcast, and we share, you know, all-around geekery.
Indeed, we do.
One other thing that we share at this particular moment is complete and utter sickness.
Yeah. We were talking about this in the mess hall right before we started recording. You've got a little bit of something going on now in your throat, unfortunately. Your wife is sick, too. I'm still coughing a little bit from the pneumonia I got from Vegas a month ago. This is ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's not even winter yet. You know, it's like, it's not flu season. It's not cold season or anything like that. It's the end of summer, and we're kind of reaching into an Indian summer. I just don't understand. It's because I live with and am married to a teacher, and all of that pestilence that you send your kids with to school.
Those vile germs.
Those vile germs. It finds its way back to my household.
And they infect you and invade your territory, and then look at what they've done to you.
And okay, that's the thing. I was talking with some friends of mine, normal people, you know, quote unquote normies.
The Muggles?
The Muggles, yeah. I was talking to them about conventions and everything like that. I was like, oh yeah, my close friend Char, she came back with con crud. And they're like, whoa, what's con crud? And I explained what it was. And they're like, oh my God, what's going on at these conventions? I was like, it's just all these people packed into one room.
Yeah, it's just getting thousands of people from all over the world together in the same area and space. And naturally, you're just going to bring some germs with you, and you might not even be aware that you're carrying something that's really gonna devastate somebody else, like hundreds of people at a place like Las Vegas. It just happens when you get that many people together, and it's unfortunate. And unfortunately, I am 2 for 2 as far as Vegas goes next year, so help me if I get sick again. I'm not coming back.
I'm so scared. I'm scared about Vegas next year, just because
I haven't
built up the nerd herd immunity that some of you guys have.
Is there a vaccination we can get? I'm not anti-vax.
Well, regardless of sickness, we are here to give you guys solid Star Trek entertainment. And besides giving you entertainment, something that kind of entertained us, or at least tickled our fancy just a smidgen, was you saw this at Vegas, and this was brought to our attention by our good friend of the show, Damian Hayward. He showed us some Catherine Janeway coins, commemorative coins.
Yeah, okay, yeah, these are some commemorative coins that are available in Australia, but you can order them, I believe, anywhere. I mean, I think we can get them here in the U.S. if we want to. And it's not just Janeway, there's also a coin with the USS Voyager on it. And they are released by the Perth Mint of Australia, and so they're totally legit. And you can get them individually, or you can get both of them as a set. And if you get them as a set, there's this really interesting kind of like transporter style display case that comes with it. The light shines down on the coins when the doors open, and it's really kind of cool. The only thing that kind of is making me reluctant to get these is the price, unfortunately. And I'm also not a coin collector. Are you a coin collector?
I'm not a coin collector in the least. Now, my grandfather is, and he has a coin collection that could probably put a kid through college. I'm not even kidding about that. And it's staggering to look at, and actually it's fun to see. It's fun to go through history. You know, it's like as he's flipping the pages, you feel like you're going further and further back in time. So I do appreciate it, but I personally don't do it. These coins, like if you wanted the set that you were going to talk about, if you want two of them, it'll cost you $145.
Yeah.
For like just an average Star Trek fan, that's a lot of money for something that's worth Like if you actually trade it in for cash, it's worth a nickel or something. Like
I mean, yeah, it's got some real silver in it and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you would have to be a collector, I think, to want these. And forgive me, coin collectors, but it feels like such a relic of the past. Like coin collections used to be a really big deal. These mm-hmm. days, I don't know many coin collectors. I really don't.
I think, you know, I feel like you used to hear it all the time as kids. You know, like I think we were like we were children when they came out with the new quarters, you know, like a quarter for each state.
Yeah, those were cool. Yeah, they
were. Yeah, those were cool. And I think there was a big resurgence of coin collecting amongst younger people because of that. But mm-hmm. I don't think that's really happening anymore, especially I know like there's way more coins out there than what's in the U.S. Mint. But people have been trying to get rid of the penny for decades.
Oh, sure. Some people just want to eliminate coin money altogether, thinking we're absolutely. In the electronic age now. Just swipe your card and get over it. I don't want to lug around all these coins, which there is a certain amount of sense that that makes to me, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I don't think we're quite there yet.
I don't think so either, because the last reason why I kept change in my car, I don't even keep it in my pockets anymore.
I don't either.
Yeah, the only reason why I left it in my car was because I was like, oh, I need it for parking meters and I need it for vending machines. Well,
yes.
Both of those have been replaced with cards or an app. Now, not all of them. No, not all of them. But the day that all of them are is the day that I'm going to stop carrying change altogether.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say those are the two big ones. And the other one that I thought of is also already obsolete, and that was payphones back in the day. You'd have to have some coinage to use a payphone, but everybody has a cell phone anymore, so you can't even find a payphone anymore.
I know, that's what I was going to say. I was like, I can't even remember the last time I saw a payphone, but like, now just imagine, now, if you took a Catherine Janeway coin and then tried to put it into the slot of a payphone, do you think you'd be able to be connected to the Delta Quadrant?
Could it connect into the Pathfinder link and somehow connect for, 5 minutes? I don't know. I don't honestly think it would be worth it because it would just be audio. There's no video in a payphone. Now, if I could put the coin in and FaceTime, maybe.
Maybe
it would be worth it. Maybe. But
well, those of you who are interested in getting these coins, you can go to perthmint.com.au. That's perthmint.com.au. And from there, you can get Benjamin Sisko. You can get Deep Space Nine. You can get
Picard.
You can get the Enterprise D. That's right. You can get Spock. Actually, no, Spock is sold out. Kirk is sold out. And the original Enterprise is sold out. So we have a lot of TOS fans, apparently, who pounced on these mints.
Like, I think it's an age thing, man. The TOSers grew up
oh my
with
gosh,
coin
you're
collections.
Right.
They're onto this, and they love it. Whereas us younger millennial generation were like, coins? That's so cute. I like them, but nah.
That is so astute. Now, granted, there are, people love TOS of all ages,
size, shapes,
and colors. But... I think that's a really astute observation because you go on perthmint.com.au and the only ones that are sold out are the TOS ones because it's not like the only ones that are sold out are Kirk, Spock, and the lady herself. And I think that's really interesting. I think that's spot on.
I rest my case. All right. Well, probably enough about coins for this week. That's not our actual topic of discussion, so we should probably move into that. This was sort of a hypothetical thing that I brought up to you and you liked it. And so we're going to go with it and we're going to transport ourselves back of, too many years now already. It's the summer of 1997. Okay, guys, almost 20 years ago at this point. I'm just in disbelief about that because I was a teenager in 1997. How did all that time pass? That's ridiculous. And anyway, it is up to us. Each of us, you and me, Tristan, to create a new Voyager character, and it's not going to be 7 of 9. What kind of character do we create? And let's talk a little bit about this person that we're creating. That is the hypothetical I brought up to you, and so I cannot wait to hear what you've got in store, because I have a little bit of a confession to make. I'm going to preface everything that I'm going to say about my character by saying I actually created a character over the summer of 1997. with this kind of a hypothetical scenario, knowing that they were going to have a new character come aboard on season four, I wrote a whole script for Scorpion Part 2 over the summer of 97. I like wrote it in a week, and I was really proud of that because that was the fastest I ever wrote anything that long. And so I'm going to talk about this character that I created way back when.
Well, I'm super excited to hear that because I did not in 1997 because I was willing, ready, and able, you know, once I heard that they were going to be doing something like Seven of Nine, you know, teenage Tristan was just like, hells yeah.
And well, now granted, take into account, we didn't know who Seven of Nine was at this particular juncture. We just knew that a new character was going to be introduced.
Yes. But the thing is like, you know, once we got later on in the summer, we're talking about the beginning of the summer.
Okay, once we did know who Seven of Nine was, or yeah, no, we could I'm saying see like, visuals.
For this podcast, we're talking about, like, Seven of Nine doesn't exist. We're in the writer's room, and we need to figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, like, later on in 97, once we found out who Seven of Nine was going to be, I was pretty stoked. And I really, just because, I think, because I also run another geek podcast, which is very, very movie-based, I need to give a tasting to the audience of 1997. So here is the highest grossing films of 1997, just to put your mind in the late 90s, okay?
Give it some context, yes.
Number 10, we have The Full Monty, then The Fifth Element, My Best Friend's Wedding, Liar Liar, As Good As It Gets, number 5 with Air Force One, number 4, Tomorrow Never Dies, number 3, In the Wayback Machine with Men in Black.
Oh yeah, baby.
Number 2, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, and number 1, Titanic.
Oh, of course it was. Yes.
That was it. That was the year of Titanic where everyone lost their freaking minds.
Oh my God. That freaking song, Celine Dion, I'll never forgive you.
So, yeah, and that's pretty much the easiest way. And here's an even geekier one for you people out there. The original Star Wars trilogy special editions are released and production began on episode 1. So, for those of you sci-fi nerds out there, which if you're listening to this show, you are. That's the mode we're in. Okay, that's the era. That's everything right there.
For the record, I was totally about the MIBs. That was the summer movie for me that year.
I remember seeing that movie. Oh, I mean, like, I watched it a billion times, but for some reason, when I think of Men in Black, a time harkened back where I was on a school field trip in middle school, and that was the movie that they showed on the bus.
Nice.
When we went to our destination. I have no idea where we went or where we were coming from, but I remember that we watched Men in Black on VHS tape.
Of course you did, because there were no DVDs in mass market really at that point.
Nope, those didn't really kick in till about 99 or 2000. So, okay. So we have the timeline established. This is, for those of you who don't remember, I mean, like, Scorpion's a big deal with Voyager.
Oh,
Kes
yeah.
is on her way out. A new character is coming in. Janeway and Chakotay are at odds on how to deal with the Borg and how to deal with Species 8472. They're trying to traverse Borg space, and they don't know if they're going to safely.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Scorpion was a huge two-parter. There was a lot at stake, and I feel like Janeway put it all on the line. You know, it's like, go big or go home. And she did.
And she did, absolutely.
She made a deal with the devil.
I want to hear what you had installed, because I love past Char. I love I love middle school and high school Char, and I love that she was a writer and that you are still a writer, but I want to hear more about her.
I don't write nearly as much as I wish I did anymore. I should really get into that, considering that I'm writing resumes and applications right now trying to get work.
Well, this Char wrote fiction, and I want to hear about that one. So let's go back. Walk us through the steps, your contemplation and your execution.
Okay, well, since this is 1997, Char, I was 15/16, turning 16 that summer, and, you know, it's summer vacation, I am going into high school, I'm in high school, I had my sophomore year completed, and I was going into my junior year. This was, incidentally, the year that I was starting to fall into depression, but that doesn't have a whole lot to do with the context of this. This was actually a great summer. I was having a lot of fun. I was learning to do things like code HTML, and I was a part of a couple of Trek communities where I was connecting with other people online, and that was my thing, is I was always online. You know, my parents, we were not poor, but we weren't rich, and we didn't take a whole lot of trips or anything like that. We didn't travel much. My parents are big homebodies. And so the way that I learned about the world was through the internet. I connected with people from all over the world. I went to places that I knew I would never really see by going to websites and seeing the pictures and capturing video and all of that great stuff. And of course, I was a big Star Trek fan, and this was like the height of Voyager for me. I was so excited about Scorpion as a two-parter, so excited that I wrote the second installment, and I think I was encouraged by a friend of mine whose name is Lisa. She and I were big Star Trek buds at the time. Like, she sort of kind of got tired of the show and stopped watching, but I kind of hung in there. But this was when we were really, really into it, her and I. And she also is a writer. She's actually writing her own series right now. She's writing the whole thing out. You know, it's like a Babylon 5, several series arc and all that. And so she's still into this big time. And she encouraged me, why don't you just write out the second part? And I thought, you know, why don't I? And so I did. And what I'll focus on is, I don't remember exactly how I resolved the Borg storyline and all that with Species 8472. I'm going to focus on the character I created. All we knew was that we were going to have a new character come aboard. And I figured it looked like Kes, I think at the time we knew that Kes was on her way out. So I knew that I was going to make her female to keep the balance. And I gave her the most generic name. Her name is Kristen Thomas. Boring. No offense to anybody named Kristen Thomas, but it's so just unoriginal. It's so average American. It's like Joe Smith. And no offense to Joe Smith, it's just, I could have tried a little harder. I mean, come on.
Might as well call her Jane Doe. So far, not off to a good start. So far, I'm judging you, Char.
Give me a moment. Give me a moment. I'm working on it. But anyway, okay. So I find it incredibly interesting now in hindsight, knowing what we know about Seven of Nine, what I did with this character. And what I did do is I made her about the same age as Seven, like late 20s, early 30s, you know, that Hollywood prime. Because of course she was going to have to be attractive. It's Hollywood. And the angle, though, that I went with it was I was going to kind of make her a trauma survivor. She got assimilated much older than Seven of Nine. Maybe she was like a late teenager, 20-something, where maybe it was Wolf 359 even. You could say that. I didn't put that into my script, but I'm just thinking now, maybe that would have worked. And so she was a human much longer than she was a Borg. And so it's much easier for her to remember her human past. And she embraces it a lot more than Seven ever did. You know, she's a lot more quick to say, okay, I'm a human again. Thank goodness. But she's tormented by her experience as a Borg. And so with her character, I wanted to really delve into, because I'm such a psychology nerd, I really wanted to delve into surviving a trauma like that, what that does to the brain, what that does to the ego and the psyche, and how is she going to interact with other people, and how is she going to progress trying to be a normal person when she knows that she has assimilated and therefore, you could say, killed thousands and thousands of people, many of them human probably. And so how do you come back from that and live with yourself? That was ultimately the arc I was going to do. And of course, since I wrote only one episode, it was, okay, I'm human now and I'm on this ship and I'm going to stay on this ship. I've been invited to stay. And she, of course, loves Captain Janeway. They immediately make a connection.
Okay.
And so they were going to be buds. Janeway was going to have a mentor type role, but in a very different way than she was with Seven. It was going to be much more of a confidant. You know, she was going to always spill her guts out to Janeway and say, how do I deal with this? Or what do I do? Or can you at least point me in the direction? Am I doing things right? Now, the one thing that I think I didn't completely think through was, what was she going to do on the ship? And to be honest, I'm not really sure. I don't think she would have run astrometrics like Seven of Nine did. Because she was not going to embrace her perfectionism, because that was Borg. And she, especially to start out, is going to reject everything Borg. She's almost the antithesis of Seven in that sense, where she hates the fact that she was a Borg. She hates what she did as a Borg, and therefore she's going to embrace humanity as much as possible, but it's going to be so difficult. It's almost like, you know how we have the Datas and the EMHs and the Sevens who Well, not the Sevens, because she is human, but the alien characters who are trying to embrace human-like qualities. Well, she is the human trying to regain her humanity. That was the big angle I was trying to go for. Mm-hmm. Kind of the different spin on it, and yet the same thing, just from a different path. And so I don't know what I would have had her do. I'm just speculating aloud right now. Like, maybe I'd have her help with Neelix in the kitchen, or, oh, I don't know. Maybe she would eventually train. Like, she would have to work her way up from the ground up to do something important on the ship. Like, she was never a Starfleet officer. So does she have to do, like, cadet training? And does she have to take courses? I don't know what she would do. But she would find her way. And I would say by season 7, she would at least have both of her feet planted on the ground and having a good sense of self. And then of course, they get home. And then I'm sure that screws her up, too. But that is kind of what I had of my character, Kristen Generic Thomas.
It's not so much the battle over individuality. It's the battle over remorse and regret
and
for
guilt.
What she was forced to do. And yes. Guilt and everything like that. So I think that's definitely an interesting take. And I think if you're going to continue with the Borg motif and the liberated Borg motif, you have to do something different than Seven. You don't want to just say like, oh, well, we'll have a different kind of Seven. You know, this is very much like the huge part of Seven's arc is individuality. I really want somebody to count how many times that word was used or variation of that word was
Lordy.
Used. Oh,
Lordy. Thousands.
And so I think taking a different spin is fun. But one question that I have for you is, we had two big things with Seven. We had the individuality thing and also her Borg implants and, you know, like how they kind of either helped her with her life on Voyager or how they hindered her life on Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
How intense would that process be? Would it be like Picard? Or would it be more like Locutus or more like Seven in that realm?
Probably more like Locutus.
Okay.
Where there's always that little buzzing in her head, reminding her of everything, just hanging with her at all times. And that's a lot to deal with.
So the physical road to recovery is nowhere near as labored because Seven was assimilated as a child and Thomas was not, correct?
Yeah, she was a Borg for, I would say, a much shorter amount of time than Seven ever was. And so she's able to recover and she doesn't need a cat suit. I never, ever, ever, ever would have done that to her. Maybe she has some sort of, maybe she's got the cortical node or something that she can't totally get rid of, at least right away. Maybe the doctor can't figure that out to begin with. But yeah, it's much more, she does look human.
Okay. All right.
But she's dealing with a lot of baggage. I do find it interesting that I did make her an ex-Borg, even though I didn't know Seven of Nine was also going to be an ex-Borg at that time. But it made sense,
cool.
Because you're dealing with the Borg, and you're not going to necessarily bring on a member of Species 8472. My rationale at the time was, okay, so they live in fluidic space. They probably, for whatever reason, can't live in our environment for too long or something like that. And so I counted that out, and so immediately it's Borg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense to me.
So that's how I got there. But, okay, so that's my character. What have you got in store, buddy? What would you do?
This one, I mean, it's nowhere near as fleshed out as yours, and it never is, but...
Oh, I don't know. You come up with good stuff.
With mine, I wanted to go... I have 20 years of hindsight, where you didn't have any when you created this character.
No.
So I wanted to do something radically different. I didn't want to do a liberated Borg. I didn't want to do anything like that. Just because, you know, we've done Seven and I want to see something a little bit different. But it's really interesting that you came up with Liberated Borg independently.
Yes, there were a lot of parallels. And I thought, man, if only I had been in the writer's room at that time, I could have pitched this. It would have happened.
It would have been amazing and it would have worked.
And that was my dream when I was a teenager, was to write the very end of Star Trek Voyager. I was going to graduate high school in 1999. I thought, well, shoot, I've got 2 years to get myself out to L.A. and become a member of the staff. Mm-hmm.
With mine is, I did the same thing where I wanted to keep a woman to keep the quotient, because if we're getting rid of Kes, we need to, you know, bring in another powerful woman. And I actually, what I did was I I started with what actress I would want to get.
Oh, interesting.
And boiled down from there. And here's the thing, and this may sound silly right off the bat, but I think in 1997, we could have made it happen. As in Paramount or CBS or, you know, the Voyager staff. Charlize Theron.
Ah, she was not exactly as big and as popular and well-known as she is today, back then.
Not even close. Now, here's the thing. Here's what she did in 95, 96, and 97. Now, Children of the Corn 3 was her first movie, and she was uncredited, and the role was young woman, okay?
Children of the Corn? This sounds like a winner.
Yeah, Children of the Corn 3, okay?
Wow.
And 96 was a cult classic, 2 Days in the Valley. Now, that got her noticed by some people, okay? Like, 2 Days in the Valley, it was a very, very weird film. It was, like I said, it became a cult classic. And then that got her noticed by some people. Then Trial and Error, which I've never even heard of in 97. But then here's what I'm thinking is that I really love the next movie, The Devil's Advocate. That is Al Pacino and Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, at least that one's kind of known by at least some portion of the population. It's out there.
Right. And that's the thing is that that was really her first very visible role to the American public. And that was in 97. And I cannot remember, I think it was in quarter four when it was released. Here's the thing, is that like she's in production for The Devil's Advocate. She has no idea if this is going to be a good movie or a bad movie, but it's got two heavy hitters. It has Al Pacino and Keanu Reeves, so it's probably going to be pretty good. Mm-hmm. But if the Paramount crew could get, like, and say like, oh, we loved you in That Thing You Do in 96, even though it was a bit part, and you were fantastic in 2 Days in the Valley, do you know what? We think TV would be fantastic for you. And she's like, well, I don't know if this film thing's going to work out. Maybe I should give it a try. And so anyway, that was my rationale. Now, granted, she did move, like, Devil's Advocate. I really liked it. I don't think it was that successful, but she got Mighty Joe Young, The Astronaut's Wife, Cider House Rules, Sweet November, and The Italian Job, and that, and then, you know, she landed it with Monster in 2003 and became a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking 6 years after 97.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my long rationale for saying I think this could work. Now, okay, so we've landed Charlize Theron. We're in the writer's room. We're like, hey, we have Charlize Theron is a huge Star Trek fan. She wants to be involved, but we don't know how. Or like, we're getting rid of Kes. So let's figure out what we can do. And so I was thinking the plan with the Borg goes south. All right.
Okay.
That happened in real life and it'll happen in our writer's room. That goes south. What's going to happen? What are they going to do? And I was thinking, well, there has to be tons of people in that region who are against the Borg and against Species 8472, but they're planning on Species 8472 to eradicate the Borg, kind of like Arturus later on when we find that out. And so I was thinking, what would be interesting is who lives around Borg space? Okay, because think about it. We have, even between Romulan space and Federation space, there's a buffer. You know, there's the neutral zone.
Yeah.
I doubt any neutral zone exists with the Borg and the surrounding space. I bet it's self-governed neutral zone where it's just like, don't go close to Borg space.
Right. It's a one-sided neutral zone. Like, if you want to live, you don't go over there.
Exactly. It's a one-sided neutral zone. And so I'm like, who is crazy enough? Who is absolutely insane enough to live on the edge of Borg space? So I was thinking that Janeway and Coco, they go and they're like, okay, the plan fell through with the Borg. It's too risky. They say it's too risky to side with Species 8472. And they're like, what else can we do? And so Janeway goes into coalition mode. It's just like, well, let's find allies. Let's find people who are struggling against the fight with the Borg and or Species 8472. And so they go out and search for people. But they're like, who are we going to find? We're in the thick of it. We're in Borg space. And, you know, because it's TV and it's great timing, they find some quote-unquote freedom fighters, assimilation fighters. What they do is they live outside Borg space, but they fight within Borg space. They do the whole tech-to-tech. They're like, oh, well, we found a mini wormhole or a subspace vacuole that kind of leads us into Borg space when we want to. But the thing is, nobody uses it because who the hell wants to go to Borg space?
Right.
They do because they're trying to dismantle the Borg any way they can. They try to get as much information they can about the Borg, about their assimilation technology, about their ships, about their ship movements. And so they have perfected stealth technology, and they use this subspace vacuole to transport outside Borg space and inside Borg space. Their ragtag leader is Charlize Theron.
All right.
And she's the leader of this small group, a very small group. It's they have a couple of ships, and she is just complete badass. She's like Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2. Okay?
All right.
She is the one who, like, she is their fearless leader. She's aggressive, she's obnoxious, but the thing is she can back it up because she knows what she's doing, and she's a genius because she understands Borg technology like no one that Catherine has ever encountered. Definitely everyone in she has more information on the Borg than anyone in the Federation.
Makes sense.
Achieved what the Hansons tried to achieve.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I like that.
Form an alliance. She doesn't want to form an alliance. She's like, who are you? You're in the wrong quadrant. You have no business, you know, being here.
I'm going to slow her down.
Yeah, exactly. You'll slow her down, and you'll slow me down. And she's like, yeah, Earth has had a few skirmishes, with the Borg. I've been dealing with the Borg my entire life, you know, and that kind of thing. Of course, she has the standard troubled past where her family was killed by the Borg, and so is everybody on the crew, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
They reluctantly agree on some sort of coalition, like the, Charlize Theron. I don't have a name for her.
It could just be Charlize Theron. I mean, that sounds like a great alien name, doesn't it? Which leads to a question. What species is Charlize Theron?
It's a species we've never seen before. That's okay. All that I can think of. I'm thinking some sort of purple hue. I don't know.
Hey.
I actually, honestly, I don't know. I'm sure because it's television, they'll be like, oh, she's alien, but she's sexy. She's sexy.
Of course she's going to be sexy. Yeah, Michael Lesmore will just nail that. We'll just assume that he's got this.
Let's just assume that she's a sexy alien, okay? That's all we need. That's all I've come up with. So, Charlize, let's call her the Theron.
The Theron.
The Theron.
That is her alien species. We are from we are the Theron.
I like that. That is the name of her species. I am Charlize of the species Theron.
Nice.
That's what it is.
Okay, great.
So she goes to Janeway and she says, okay, you want to use her subspace vacuole, but we're the only ones that have the frequency. We're not just going to let anybody use it. So you have to help us pull off this job. This one last job.
Okay? Of course, yeah.
There's always one last job.
Isn't there? Yeah.
And so that's what they do. And Janeway's like, all right, okay, so we're going to steal something from the Borg. I have no idea what it is. I have absolutely zero clue what it is, but it's the MacGuffin, okay? It's the rabbit's foot from Mission Impossible 3, okay? It doesn't matter what it does, but it's important. And in fact, let's call it the rabbit's foot. Okay, so they're stealing. They're going to steal the rabbit's foot.
Okay, we're going to go a little James Bond where that's some sort of like subspace transistor thing. It's superior communication that the Borg use. And so she's trying maybe to hack into their net a little bit to understand their whereabouts or something. And she needs that.
Sure, whatever pleases you.
Yeah.
Like, completely secondary. But yeah, all communications right, array, whatever. And so they go, and her ragtag team, okay, so there's three ships, okay? Charlize's ship and then two others. And that, in combination with Voyager, they raid this station, and it just so happens to have the Queen on it. And so we get the Queen again, but a very much more minor role. It's more of a glorified cameo in this episode.
Oh, okay. Is Alice Krieg available, or is it the Susanna Thompson Borg?
In my version, Alice Krieg is available. So.
Okay, great, great, great. It's like one day of shooting. She's got this.
It's one day. It's an afternoon, okay? Alice, that's all we need. It's just an afternoon.
Well,
please.
After she gets in all the makeup. I mean, she had to be there at 5 a.m, but yeah.
Right. And so they pull off this job. And it is successful. They deal a major blow to the Borg, and that's all that Charlize wanted to do her entire life was this one job. Her entire life was spent on figuring out what would be the biggest blow and then pulling that off. Voyager has something special, okay? They have something that makes it possible, and so it's a true partnership, and they pull it off. But the thing is that those two other ships were destroyed. Voyager's heavily damaged, and so Charlize and her crew, her small ragtag team, they have to abandon her ship.
Mm.
They abandon ship, but Voyager beams them over, and then Voyager uses the vacuole. And it's the whole, you know, like, oh, you know, it's, the vacuole's closing behind us. You know, like, we got to move faster. You know, the Borg, you know, like, the Borg are closing it off. And so they make it just outside of Borg space. With that in mind, they're like, okay, well, there's no going back. Janeway calls Charlize into the ready room or whatever. And she says, listen, okay, so you can't go back to Borg space. They know who you are. They'll be looking for you. And the vacuole is closed. And she's like, yeah, I know that. She's lost. She has no idea what she's going to do with her life. Her entire life was devoted to defeating the Borg. Jane mm-hmm. was like, how about I give you a new mission? Tuvok is my security chief. He is amazing at what he does. He knows how to run this ship and he knows how to combat anything that comes our way. But the thing is that it would be great to have somebody on board who knows what's coming and knows what's out there and is ferocious enough to do the work that maybe Tuvok can't do or maybe, doesn't want to do.
Yeah, make him think out of the box.
Yeah, I'm making it sound much more sinister than I intended. Take the sinister part out of it, okay? Like it's not like she's going to be her henchman or something like that where she's going to do dirty work and just like, you know, like
she's going to be the Voyager hitman.
Yeah, nothing like that. Take the sinisterness out of it. What it's going to be is, okay, did you ever play Star Trek Voyager Elite Force?
No, I didn't, and I really wish I had, because I heard it was a great game.
It is probably the best Star Trek game ever made, in my personal opinion. It's definitely my favorite, and it takes place on Voyager. I mean, it's mm-hmm. Star Trek Elite Force, but it takes place on Voyager. The second one takes place on the Enterprise E, but it was great. It was a first-person shooter, and they had a thing called the Hazard Team.
Okay.
And it was this team, think of it like the Makos. Mm-hmm. In Enterprise. I think it's pretty much the Makos before the Makos. I'm pretty sure the Makos were an idea that was branched off of the Elite Force.
Oh.
And so what it was a team on Voyager who would do the dangerous away missions. Like whenever okay. the away missions were going to have, like they knew that there was going to be a lot of shooting and a lot of danger, not just information gathering, not just, you know, like, oh, look at this plant, let's gather it, you know, like nothing like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, like we got to go guns a-blazing, and if you're on the front lines, you may not come back.
Exactly. And so I want Catherine and Tuvok to say, Charlize of the planet Theron, or of the race Theron, she would be a great team leader for the Hazard Team.
She would, because it sounds to me like she's a great tactician.
Yes.
You know, she has that think out of the box mentality and also Maquis elements here, where yes. you're not going to go by the Starfleet book all the time. And she's going to have to challenge that a lot to get the job done. But what she does, what she knows, it'll work. Mm-hmm. And so she's mm-hmm. going to fight for it. And I don't know, I see a lot of potential here because you're going to appeal a little bit to that ragtag, the Maquis out there. Maybe she becomes friends with B'Elanna and Chakotay, but mm-hmm. then also befriends Tuvok because she has a unique set of expertise that helps him as well as the whole ship.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly what I'm looking for. And like, and that's the thing is that we get Charlize and we also get a whole bunch of other people too. Uh-huh. Now they're going to be minor characters. It's going to be kind of like Mulcahy and Chell and everything like that, you know, like characters on that level where we don't really get too much focus on them, but we know who they are and what they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With this, we get this resurgence of Janeway wants her there. Tuvok wants her there. She is not challenging Tuvok's authority. Like Charlize is the head of Hazard Team, but she still reports to Tuvok.
Okay. Yeah.
So like she deals with inner team, you know, management. He, you know, gives the broad stroke orders, and there's going to be some butting heads. There's going to be somebody like there's going to be that very much Seven of Nine aesthetic where she goes to Janeway and says, you brought me on. Remember, like I did not come to you and say you need a hazard team. You came to me and said you need a hazard team. And so if you want me to do things, I'm going to do them my way. And then like so whenever they butt heads, she's like, listen, you called me. You told me to do this. If you can't handle the way I do things, then maybe I shouldn't be on this ship. You know, like and so it just kind of goes back and forth. Kind of like Seven of Nine, but a little bit more badass. And so we also, maybe we have some, like, you know, Tuvok says, you can pick any team members you want who are interested. It doesn't have to just be your team. You can bring on people from Voyager. And they start to notice that more Maquis people than Federation mm-hmm. people are joining the Hazard Team. Maybe that could be a way, because this is the beginning of season 4, we can bring back that, you know, maybe the little bit of that bad blood where, I mean, maybe Charlize is a bit of an instigator. Like, really? Like, you're not really Maquis anymore, are you? And they go like, well, of course we're Maquis. You're like, okay, what are you doing that's still Maquis? I mean, you're a man or you're a woman without a mission. You're like, your mission is to get mm-hmm. home, not liberate your people.
Yeah.
So she kind of instigates it, and then maybe we get some friction. And so we have this love-hate relationship with Charlize from the planet Theron.
I kind of like that. That would be really interesting, too, especially in season four when they find out that the Maquis have been basically obliterated. They don't exist mm-hmm. anymore in the Alpha Quadrant. Then what?
Then what? That's my character. That's my story. And yeah.
All right. I like Charlize of Theron. She would be an interesting, different conflict than what we had with Seven of Nine. And I don't want to say more badass, but just badass in a different way.
Yes, in a different way. That's the thing. It's just like, you know, Seven was very sciencey and, you know, had the bombshell thing going on and was very smart and awkward. And Charlize of Theron is, you know, like, is of course very beautiful, but not in a bombshell way. Like, she's not going to be presented in a bombshell way. She can kick ass like Seven, but in a much more aggressive, furious way. She's a tactician. She's going in for the kill. Like, where Seven does it out of pure pragmatism, Charlize does it out of veracity.
I like it. Now, here's a question for you. Does she wear a uniform? And if she does, she's not a Starfleet officer, so does she wear the Maquis rank? And what rank does she have as a team leader?
Completely isolated. Unique uniforms and unique rank. So it's treated much more like if Federation is the Navy, then she would be much more like Marine. So it would be very different in ranking. Like she wouldn't be captain or commander. She would be like a major.
Okay.
Or something like that. It would be a field rank of major.
Gotcha. Okay.
And a lot like how the Makos were, you know, in Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to rip off of the Makos. I'm trying to rip off of Elite Force. No, it's but even in Elite Force, I mean, they were Federation and Maquis. They had Starfleet uniforms and they had the rank, whatever they were according to. But since these were non-Starfleet people and even non-humans and everything like that, I think I really want to go into that realm where it's unique uniforms, a unique rank system, just something that looks Starfleet, but much more tactical.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Well, Seven of Nine replacements aren't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this week, and so here's a little glimpse at what else is happening on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Is there that awkward part like near the end where he's like walking back to his shuttle like, so will this take me back, or...
You said it wasn't very fast. Can I go fast enough to slingshot around the sun?
Can we slingshot the Dyson Sphere? Because that's basically a sun.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, really, she's following the Hasbrat, I think, is really what it is.
Come for the revolution, stay for the Hasbrat.
It's got to be fresh Hasbrat. None of that replicated stuff.
Like, Daniel's like, at the watching the end of this episode, like, tears are coming down the face. It's like, no, it's the Hasbrat. It's so spicy. It's what it is.
The Orb.
Well, apparently, and did you find this interesting, Matthew? Apparently, the Navark reports directly to the prophets.
Which is awkward, because they don't always show up for meetings, so...
Right.
Yeah.
Plus, you never know what time the meeting is really going to be, right?
That is true. It could have been yesterday, and you might have missed it.
The Ready Room.
Do you think this episode would have been so popular and remain a fan favorite if the Enterprise had been overrun with zebra mussels?
To the journey! The crew attempts to rescue three aliens in stasis from a bizarre program based on fear.
Like all fear, you eventually vanish.
Warp 5.
It kind of like is akin to when fans saw the Galaxy class in The Next Generation for the very first time, and you had basically a crew and civilian complement of, what, over 1,000 people? About two-thirds of that complement were civilians and their families. So you actually did have teachers and scholars and scientists and their extended families on board.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
One of the things that amazes me about the score for Star Trek The Motion Picture is that he only had 50% of the movie available to him when he scored. So he was scoring an awful lot to scene missing, seen missing.
The 602 Club.
Where did he get the cloak from on the other planet? I really, really, really want to know. He shows up with the cloak.
He kind of fashioned it out of a rudimentary lathe.
Literary treks.
It's a small point, but I thought it was really interesting to have here in the book because, again, that's what Star Trek Deep Space Nine has really always done for Star Trek, which is kind of make faith okay in the Star Trek universe and show how it's valid. And so I thought that was a really nice... It's a tiny point in the book, but I thought it was pretty powerful, at least for me, who is somebody who is of faith. So,
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
And we have her to thank for the fact that Deanna Troi only has two breasts.
Yes, thank you.
Now.
Thank you, DC Fontana, for sparing us from a three-breasted Troi.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of our shows. We're available on any method that you could possibly want to get on your podcast. We are on Spreaker, we're on SoundCloud, you can go to the website and download there. And of course, the most important still is iTunes. So if you haven't left us a review, you know what to do. That is probably the best way to help us slide up in the rankings, expose more people to the show, and get more people listening. And then it's just this wonderful cycle that feeds into itself. More and more and more and more, the more the merrier. And then we've got ourselves this awesome party like we do and, you know, get on the bandwagon. We love it. But if you're not investing in those Voyager coins and you've got a little bit of spare change that you can give to us, go to patreon.com and consider becoming a subscriber because Trek FM is a listener-supported network and we rely on our listener base to help us keep this network going for the storage, the distribution, the bandwidth, you name it. It is all helped out by you folks. And we want to thank our associate producers, Aaron Harvey, Jamie Deuce, and Kenneth Tripp for being associate producers of To the Journey. So we really thank them, but we thank everybody who supports us on Patreon because we frankly could not do this without you anymore. So thank you. Now, all of that said, we got to go on to next week.
That's right. We got to go into next week. And next week is going to be interesting. It's going to be fun. It may be a little weird because we're doing something that we haven't done before. What if the Voyager crew had a much more sardonic view on their chances on getting home? Okay, so we saw this where they had many conversations happened early on where they're like, you know what? People are going to start pairing off, you know, like, and, you
yeah,
know,
come
like,
on, Harry.
Come on, Harry, they're going to start having babies. Do we need to build a nursery? You know, like these questions were asked, but what if they were taken more seriously? What if the crew had a view like, you know what, we might not get home. Why wait to live life? Let's live life now. And so what you and I, Shar, are going to talk about for the viewers next week is who would pair off with who and why and what would be ridiculous about it or what would be good about it. But you'll have to tune in next week to hear. So until then, this has been To the Journey.
To the Journey!